Welcome to the Binder Family Speaker Series, a podcast dedicated to high-level research on contemporary anti-Semitism by fostering productive and collegial discussion of the most pertinent issues before us. Hosted by the Indiana University Institute for the Study of Contemporary Anti-Semitism. For more information about this speaker series, ISCA news, or videos of past webinars, please visit our website at isca.indiana.edu. And now to present our speaker, Dr. Alvin H. Rosenfeld.
And welcome, Father John. Good to see you. We're so glad you're with us. I won't elaborate any further on what Gunther just said about the events of this week. They've been horrific, as we all know, and we're in the grip, really, of a great fear that lie about matters that may still lie ahead. That's not our subject today, although our subject today is not altogether unrelated. I must say, when we drew up this series several months ago, we recognized that anti-Semitism, as you all know, is multi-causal. It doesn't originate in any one particular ideological or religious or political belief. It's multifaceted. And in that variety of causes, within the Western world for sure, Christian thinking, Christian theology, Christian teachings and preachings over a long period of time played a decisive role. There are any of a number of very thoughtful, devoted Christians who've recognized as much. Father John Polakowski is certainly one of them. John, you and I date back a long time. We've both served on the committees at the Holocaust Museum. For those of you who are not familiar with Father Polakowski's work, he was instrumental, along with others, in helping to develop the Holocaust Museum in D.C. Four times he held presidential appointments to the major committee guiding the work of the museum. And for many, many years, he's given really very thoughtful scrutiny to the role of Christian teachings vis-a-vis Judaism and the Jews. That's going to be his subject today. John, we're really privileged and honored to have you with us. And I'm going to not say any more and just hand over to you for your presentation.
Well, thank you very much, Alvin. It's great to be with you and Gunther. But of course, as you mentioned, our relationship goes back to your initial days, actually, at Indiana University, where you ran some important conferences to which you invited me, in addition to our work in connection with the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Again, I want to focus on the subject at hand, but I also want to identify myself with the statement of Gunther and to say that certainly the Hamas agenda is clearly a new form of an anti-Semitism that would want to wipe out Jews and Israel from the map of the world. And I think that is something we have to make clear. And it's been interesting to me that even a person like Reverend Barber, who's a well-known leader in civil rights at the present time, published an op-ed the other day in which he said, we have to say no to Hamas, a resilient no, even though he has been associated over the years with critiques regarding Israel's treatment of Palestinians. And I think it was important that a person like himself, who is viewed as a moral leader in many areas, came out so forcefully with such moral clarity on the fundamental issue of no to Hamas. So I'll leave it at there. In terms of the kind of history of the growth of anti-Semitism, and it's what I would call seeding of anti-Semitism in the heart of Christianity over the centuries. I'd like to go back to the very beginning in a way, and that is the period of the first century and the New development of the New Testament. Now, scripture scholars have not en masse, but a fair number of prominent scripture scholars have discussed the issue of anti-Semitism in the New Testament. Can you actually brand the parts of the New Testament as anti-Semitic? By and large, scripture scholars who have studied the question have been reluctant to label the New Testament texts themselves as anti-Semitic. Now, that doesn't mean they haven't criticized certain texts, and I'll say a bit more about that in a moment, but they've refrained sort of from using the term anti-Semitic. Now, generally speaking, the scripture scholars tend to attribute the supposed hostility between Jews and the newly emergent Christian community as a matter of almost internal Jewish strife, since indeed Judaism was a wide tent at the time of Jesus and the early church, and many of the people who did accept Jesus's teachings still regarded themselves as within the framework of this rather wide tent of Judaism. However, that does not resolve the issue, because for me, there's a difference between the kind of nuancing that academic biblical scholars can bring forth in terms of internal battles within parts of the Jewish community, internal battles within parts of the newly emerging Christian community. However, those kinds of nuances on a scientific level often get lost when we get into the public sector. And so when the average Christian, a Christian scholar, but not a biblical scholar, who may not be really informed about some of the many internal battles going on within the wide Jewish tent at the time of Jesus and the formation of Christian doctrine, Christian belief, they tend to read some of these statements in a very, if not anti-Semitic view, anti-Judaic view. Now, we've had this ongoing scholarly discussion over the years as to whether there is a difference between anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism. There is some difference, because ultimately not all anti-Judaism espouses the total annihilation of Jews. Anti-Semitism frequently prescribed, and certainly within the Nazi ideology, prescribed the total annihilation of Jews, something we see replicated, I believe, in the current framework of Hamas's approach to Jews and Judaism. There are three sections, if you want, of the New Testament that I think did help create an anti-Judaic view of Jews and Judaism within the early Christian community, and really planted the seeds for a millennium, more than two millennium long misunderstanding of the Jewish-Christian relationship that has been partially overcome by the Second Vatican Council's Nostra Aetate declaration, but I hesitate to say that it's been overcome completely. I think too many Christians, even Christians who have been deeply committed to Christian-Jewish relations, have tended to give a false impression that everything has been solved. It has not been solved. I think the seeds of my thesis is that the seeds of Judaism, while they may not be sprouting in some areas right now in the way that they did in the past, nonetheless, as long as those seeds remain, the potential for anti-Semitism based on those teachings remains very real and remains alive. And until we really remove those seeds from Christian self-understanding, from Christian theology, we have not really solved completely the challenge of anti-Semitism within the Christian tradition. We have not truly removed the so-called shadow that still remains over the cross because of the history of anti-Semitism. There is absolutely no question that whatever the scholarly findings about the origins of some of these problematical texts in the New Testament, the vast majority of Christians understood those texts in an anti-Judaic way. And so we can at least say that the New Testament gave a foundation for anti-Judaic interpretations of the Christian-Jewish relationship and interpretations that frequently aided and abetted concrete acts of anti-Semitism in the Christian community, whether in the Middle Ages or in the period of Nazism and so on. In fact, while I have argued consistently that the Nazi philosophy is towards the Jews, well, it certainly is not simply a straight line development from basic Christian teaching. There is no question in my mind that indeed on the grassroots level, that the Nazi ideology would not have taken hold in Europe in the way that it did and in the effects that it had on the slaughter of Jews if it were not for this historic Christian anti-Semitism. Many of the people in the European populations in countries like Germany, Italy, Austria, and so on, Poland, endorsed or at least acquiesced to what the Nazis were doing because of this historic anti-Semitic tradition. Now, the three areas in the New Testament that I would initially lift up as contributing to the formation of an anti-Judaic view within the as essential to Christian self-understanding are, first of all, certain sections of the Gospel of John where Jews are said to be have Satan as their father, are portrayed in a as people who are mired in darkness and ignorance and so on. It's a very, very negative view. And I think it's the implication of that teaching in the Gospel of John had ramifications even beyond the Christian-Jewish dialogue. feminist scholar Elizabeth Schussler-Fiorenza, I think, made a good point a number of years ago when she said that the implication of what is said in the Gospel of John amounted to a religious validation for fundamental hatred. And that affected first and foremost the Jews, particularly in the history of Christianity, but also had impact beyond the Christian-Jewish relationship. And it led, I think that was a very important observation on her part. Now, one of the biblical scholars that has done considerable work in the area of Christian-Jewish relations, the Johannine scholar, the late Father Raymond Brown, has basically said that these statements in the New Testament, which refer to Jews as having Satan as their father, as being people wallowing in darkness and so on, should no longer be seen as authentic teachings for today. Should not be used in the liturgy, should not be used in catechetical educational programs and so on. That's a commendable position, I think, on the part of Father Brown, who in the end, actually, just before he died, really affirmed the fundamental relationship in a positive way between Judaism and Christianity as he saw it in the teachings of Jesus. He said at one time in a public speech, actually here in Chicago, that after many, many years of studying this question as a scholar, he had come to the conclusion that if St. Paul had in fact had a son, he would have had him circumcised. That was an indication that indeed, whatever Paul, and he's a central figure here in this question of the formation of Christian, early Christian attitudes towards Jews and Judaism, at least Brown came to the conclusion that Paul still considered active incorporation into the Jewish community a positive development for anyone who was a Christian. Now, he made that comment not too long, as I said, not too long before he died, and so he never really amplified on it. But the other question that Brown raised was, and this is an extremely serious question from the scholarly point of view, but also affects Christian belief. How do you handle the passages in the New Testament, such as those in John, in a critical way? I think what we have not really developed in Christianity in recent years, especially since the time of the Second Vatican Council, was a legitimate hermeneutic of criticism of the scriptures. Can a religious institutions ever really affirm that some of their proclamations are in error? And that is not an easy question for any religious tradition to deal, because religious traditions are almost kind of founded on the idea that they contain the truth, and that even that the issue of the truth has been one that's been affirmed over and over again, certainly within the Christian community, both in all three major branches of the Christian community. So for someone like Father Brown to say we certain passages in the New Testament are no longer valid catechesis for the Christian community really represents a major new development, I think, in Christianity, and one that even the scripture scholars have not widely accepted at this point. It's one thing to interpret a text and say, well, it's been misunderstood. It's another thing to say, no, it isn't misunderstood. It is simply wrong, and therefore should no longer be part of the official teaching or liturgy of the Christian community. And we haven't quite come to that. It's an issue, actually, that I have raised in a chapter that I have written for Fesher, for my colleague, Father Leo Leffert-Moore, who teaches at Georgetown University, which hopefully will appear in print soon. But I believe I have not seen anyone else really raise that question. This is important because certainly in the Catholic tradition, because prior to Vatican II, Catholics were really not advised or encouraged to read the Bible. They were encouraged to buy very expensive versions of the Bible, mostly the New Testament, for their coffee table. But they were not really encouraged because fear was they'll misinterpret. Now, there was a profound change in that attitude at Vatican II. In fact, one can say that one of the most important new developments that emerged from Vatican II was the restoration of the scripture as the major point of self-definition within Catholicism. The emphasis on scripture was far more a Protestant thing than a Catholic thing. Historically. Probably the Orthodox Christian community were somewhat closer to the Catholic community in this regard than they were to the Protestant community. But the Gospel of John and its statements about the satanic quality of Judaism certainly is one of the major problems still remaining with respect to the New Testament. The second one I would emphasize is the Pharisee. The Pharisees historically, and even in much of the present day, have been seen as the arch enemies of Jesus. In some ways, they really play the role of Judaism in the mind of most Christians who read the New Testament. They don't know much of who the Pharisees were, and that's a terribly problematical situation. But they really kind of see them as representing all the bad things that Jesus rejected about Jews and Judaism in his time. And of course, that is a total falsification. I don't know how many sermons I've heard against the poor Pharisees. I have become their defender over the years in certain situations. There has been some progress, but there's still a major, major problem about the distortion of Judaism in the name of the Pharisees, and how much that distortion is attributed to Jesus and his so-called battles with the Pharisees. I can't go into all the Pharisee scholarship at this point, but the first point we have to understand is the Pharisees were not a univocal group. They had many different subgroups. The late David Flusser once said that he could discern about seven different orientations within the wide Pharisaic community. And those various viewpoints often clash within the Pharisaic movement. Sometimes I compare it to a political primary here in the United States, because in a political primary election, people who supposedly are part of the same party say some very nasty things against their opponents in the primary elections. And so it's not unusual for people who kind of share or claim to share the same religious vision, say, can dispute the nature of that vision in quite harsh languages. In recent times, particularly since the summer of 2019, there's been some significant advance in at least the academic understanding of Phariseeism within the Catholic community. In 2019, in the summer of 2019, just before the big outbreak of COVID, the Pontifical Institute that is associated with the Gregorian University in Rome staged a major conference on Phariseeism. This is really the first comprehensive conference of its kind dealing with Phariseeism. And it was part of the 150th anniversary celebration of the Pontifical Gregorian University, the Jesuit University in Rome, which is generally acknowledged as the most important of the Catholic universities in Rome. In this conference, every aspect of Phariseeism and the relationship between Phariseeism and the teachings of Jesus was emphasized. It brought, it gave scholarly meat, if you want, to the affirmation which very few Christians, Catholic Christians, are aware of, even scholars. In 1985, in a document for the 20th anniversary of Nostra Aetate's Chapter 4, the Vatican clearly asserted that Phariseeism was the Jewish vision that was closest to the teachings of Jesus. They did not assert that Jesus was a Pharisee, but that indeed he took much good from the teachings of Phariseeism and so on. This resulted in a formal statement from Pope Francis, which was given to the conference in Rome, asserting that it was the obligation of Christian scholars, but also to make clear to the Christian community, Catholic Christian community, that these typical, stereotypical images of Jews and of Jews as Pharisees and in opposition, to wholesale opposition to the teachings of Jesus, have to literally be wiped out of Christian teaching because they are false. And Francis gave papal support to that effort. Now, I have to be very clear and say that, unfortunately, Francis has not always taken his own advice. We have instances where one might say, popular statements, popular homilies, as you may or may not know, there's a long tradition where the Pope has a kind of public session each Wednesday and then gives a presentation. Well, on several occasions, he has himself fallen into typical views of the relationship between Jesus and the Pharisees. This is most unfortunate, but I think the formal statement he contributed to this conference in 219 is an important rebuttal, I think, of the otherwise kind of classical views of Phariseeism that he himself has put forth on occasion. Now, the papers from this conference are now available in a book that is edited by Professor, co-edited by Professors Joseph Sievers and Amy Jill Levine, if anyone is interested in following up on this whole question. But I think Phariseeism has clearly been a source of major negativity within the Christian, Catholic Christian tradition regarding Jews and Judaism. The third issue I would raise are the teachings of St. Paul. St. Paul was for many, many years regarded as the person who really set the stage by his missionary journeys and so on for the separation of Judaism and Christianity. And that's usually attributed to the so-called meeting between Peter and Paul and so on, in which clearly one can read the New Testament as affirming the victory of Paul over Peter, with Peter espousing a sense of continuing ties between Judaism and the new religious community of Christians, whereas Paul seemed to really break, especially on law, regarding the interpretation of the obligations of the Torah. There's no question that Paul was espousing entrance of non-Jews into the covenantal relationship as he understood it, had been promulgated by Jesus in his preaching. And he faced many obstacles in that. And we know that, for example, Corinth, he tried to model a sacred service for the Corinthians that would be similar to what was happening in Judaism. And it was, in fact, pretty much of a fiasco. And so then he started making compromises, saying, no, new Christians do not have to abide by many of the rules and obligations of the Torah tradition. But that doesn't mean he intended to say they had no value. And there's been a fair amount of scholarly reinterpretation of Paul, major reinterpretation, which I think on the popular level is not really understood within the Christian community. Literally, the understanding of Paul in the last several decades among Christian scripture scholars, especially people like Christer Sendall and others, has been turned upside down. And this is reflecting, this is where I would reaffirm what I already said about Raymond Brown's assertion that he thought Paul would have had a son circumcised, which means he would have really gone through the process of integrating his son in a sacred way into the Jewish community. I think there's been a lot of reinterpretation of Paul's approach to the law. Some of it, fortunately or unfortunately, was rather pragmatic. I mean, he wanted to bring certain people into the community, but they were not really ready to follow. They had no idea what Torah was, what it required, and how to carry it out. In fact, there are even some scripture scholars who would argue that Paul deliberately forbade some of the new Christians from taking up Torah observance because he was afraid that they would undermine its sacredness. Now, that can be a bit of a stretch in terms of academic documentation, but nonetheless, that view is out there in some circles and so on. The Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium ran a three-year conference or symposium on the issue of Paul and Judaism. The papers from that three-year project are also available in book form. I participated in that effort, even though I'm not a scripture scholar. I was invited to participate in that effort, in part because I actually was a visiting professor at the Catholic University of Leuven for part of the time that study was underway. But clearly, Paul's a kind of, an incomplete understanding of Paul's teaching on law has certainly been a great source of at least theological anti-Judaism, which often resulted in concrete acts of against Jews and Judaism in various Christian communities over the centuries. So I think that would be the third aspect of the New Testament where I think we can say the prevailing interpretation may not be the soundest academic understanding, but the prevailing interpretation continued to solidify seeds of anti-Judaism, anti-Semitism in official Christian teaching. Now, where this process really takes hold most strongly is among the church fathers. The anti-Judaic theology that took root in most of Christianity beginning in the second century, in writers like Tertullian, Justin, Origen, and so on, really went beyond what the New Testament presents us. And some of it became linguistically vicious, particularly in John Chrysostom, but it also set the significant self-definition parameters for Christian identity. So Christian identity, which of course the Catholics shared in, that was before the splits, but Christian identity was formulated in a way that reflected the teachings of the church fathers. Now, this is the church fathers in contemporary Christianity have a somewhat differing role as you move from Catholicism to Orthodoxy to Protestantism. They are most heavily influential in Orthodox Christianity, secondarily in Catholic Christianity, and far less in, generally speaking, in Protestant Christianity, although there you have to nuance a bit because of differing views among the various denominations that constitute the Protestant tradition. But Protestants have generally been more focused on emphasizing biblical tradition rather than the patristic tradition. But the church fathers Tertullian, Justin, Origen, they basically, first of all, they argued that the hatred for the Jews was something that God himself shared. That in fact, God wanted to get rid of what he now considered a burdensome relationship with the Jewish people, and that he wanted something new and fresh. And this is what Christianity provided. So it's a very negative view, basically a understanding that the Jewish covenant has been fundamentally replaced by the new Christian covenant. I think one can make the argument that when in the New Testament there's talk of a new covenant, that could be interpreted far more in the minds along the lines of the prophet Jeremiah and Deuteronomy, a covenantal restatement, covenantal renewal is not unknown in the Jewish tradition, but it's covenantal renewal, not covenantal rejection, wholesale rejection. And that's the problem. It became covenantal wholesale rejection in the Christian community. I think we certainly, the problem that I see is that with these church fathers is that most scholars who work on their writings don't really even take up the issue of their attitude towards the Jews. I don't know how many books I've looked at by people writing in this area that never mention these very significant and defining views among the fathers with respect to the framing of the initial self-definition of Christianity. It gets frustrating because I think today, not many scholars would write to in a way of defending these views, but they don't want to critique them either. Again, because I think for many of them, it represents a real challenge that I already spoke about. How do you critique what is very fundamental to the self-definition of a religious tradition? How do you do that and still preserve the authenticity of the tradition? And I think that's something we really have not totally dealt with that within Christian academic circles, especially in this area. We've kind of buried the issue by simply not talking about it. And that I think is something I think we have to talk about it, and I think we have to formally root it out. Now, among the church fathers, I think the one person who emerges as especially significant is St. Augustine. Because St. Augustine framed what is really a central theological tenet in Christian self-identity. And that is that Jews were to be seen as what he called witness people, the witness theory of Christian-Jewish relations espoused by Augustine, which basically argued that Jews were expelled from the covenant permanently. They were replaced there by the Christians, but they should not be murdered. So, this was not a genocide. This was not a call for genocide, because Jews in Augustine's mind were to be kept alive. But why would they be Why should they be kept alive? And in one sense, protected even. It was because they serve as a permanent witness to the sufferings that you will undergo if you reject Jesus. And so Jews were never to have a homeland of their own. That was it. No longer ever to have a homeland of their own. They were to be socially marginalized and made miserable. And of course, that became the template for so-called Christian societies in Europe for centuries and centuries and centuries. Jews were marginalized. Jews were suffered even worse than that. I mean, I think Paula Friedrichsen, who wrote a book somewhat defending Augustine, saying, no, Augustine, and she was correct in the sense he did not espouse genocide. He really wanted to keep the Jews alive. However, my concern about Paula Friedrichsen's thesis is that she tends to let Christians off the hook on that, let Augustine off the hook. It can be said, and I want to say this carefully, it can be said that Augustine planted the seeds for the close to 1 million Jews who died in future centuries of Christianity, something that Father Ed Flannery, the late Father Ed Flannery, said in his groundbreaking volume, The Church and the Jews, a number of decades ago. So, I mean, I'm not accusing Augustine of genocide, but he laid seeds that had genocide potential. And part of those seeds did sprout over the centuries in Christianity. And many of us know the history of that in various forms, whether it was the Crusaders, whether it was other more recent forms of Christianity. And I would have to say that they seeded the development of real anti-Semitism within important parts of the Catholic community, even in the 19th and 20th centuries. Now, in a sense, Augustine established a foundation for how Christian self-identity explained the relationship to Jews and Judaism. And not much changed. Here and there were some improvements. And many of these were due to more enlightened political leaders of the time. Certainly, for example, the reason why many Jews fled Spain after the expulsion by Ferdinand and Isabella and escaped to Poland. Many of them, did so because certain Polish princes had a much more positive view towards Jews and Judaism, a much more positive view, in fact, than what the church had. And many of these princes were criticized by church leaders for having a too positive attitude towards Jews. Now, when time is running out, but as we come to the more modern period, yes, there have been some developments, even recent developments. Obviously, Nostra Aetate did fundamentally change the Augustinian theological vision. In fact, the late Gregory Baum, who was a pioneer in developing positive Catholic-Jewish relations, said in a major paper at the Catholic Theological Society some years ago, that in his view, the change in Catholic teaching in chapter 4 of Nostra Aetate represented the most profound change in the ordinary magisterium of the church to come out of the council. Now, you could raise some questions there. Not that it was a very profound change, but that there were some other profound changes as well, including, for example, in religious liberty. So there have been certainly Pope John Paul II, in his book Crossing the Threshold, denounced anti-Semitism as fundamentally sinful. And for on a popular level, that did have some effect. I remember a conversation with some Polish priest who said that actually people began mentioning that when they went to their anti-Semitism, they confessed their anti-Semitism in the sacrament of penance, of confession, and so on. There was a recent study, very recent study that deserves more attention, undertaken at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, Jesuit University, about contemporary attitudes of Catholics in the United States towards Jews and Judaism. And basically, they were rather positive. But at the same time, Catholics just seemingly have a much more positive view to Jews as persons that they shared with whom they shared a social setting. However, the study also revealed that few, if any, Catholics really understood the profound changes that the Second Vatican Council had brought about. They didn't understand the teachings of the Second Vatican Council. They weren't even familiar with them. And so in that sense, the seeds are still there. A certain emphasis on human rights today, a certain emphasis of the fundamental democratic tradition in which we live has, I think, removed the immediate impact of those seeds. But how permanent is that? That's what troubles me. And therefore, I think we have to have a more explicit rejection of those seeds. Now, finally, I would say, right now we are celebrating, let me put celebrating in question, the 25th anniversary of the statement we remember of the Shoah that confronted anti-Semitism, particularly anti-Semitism and its manifestation during the Nazi Holocaust. That document, unfortunately, it does include an important statement from Pope John Paul in the foreword, had some major flaws that were forced upon the text by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger when he was head of the doctrinal office in the Vatican. And the document was written primarily by the Australian Cardinal Cassidy, who was the president of the Holy See's Commission for Religious Relations with the Jews. But Cardinal Cassidy personally shared with me the kind of pressure that was put on him by Cardinal Ratzinger to include certain descriptions of the, particularly of anti-Semitism and during the Holocaust regarding Paul Pius XII, but especially that the only Catholics who were anti-Semitic were wayward Catholics who followed wayward preachers. Well, nonsense. If you go to historic Catholic cathedrals, especially the one in Strasbourg, France, where you have the famous picture of depiction of Judaism and Christianity as Christianity portrayed as a bright, vivacious young woman holding the gospel, and Judaism portrayed as a bent over, old, blindfolded old woman kind of holding a broken Torah. I took the official tour one time in Strasbourg, and I was wondering what the guide was going to say. And I thought he would maybe just ignore it. Well, no, he didn't. As soon as we got to the spot, because it's on the outer facade, he said, stopped us and pointed up there, and he said, well, that represents the unity of Judaism and Christianity. I wanted to shout out an expletive, but I felt that a certain clerical propriety prevented me from doing that. But you can see this could have been an important teaching moment during that tour to explain and to help root out the teaching. And they fail in this. But again, it's similar to books on Augustine, the church, other church fathers, and so having nothing on their anti-Semitic or at least anti-Judaic viewpoint, which were not just a little minor parts of their teaching, but for many of them, constituted the heart of their effort to really establish the formal self-definition of Christianity. So I'll leave it at that. I think we have some time for questions now, and I would really appreciate receiving those. So thank you very much.